with the University of Wisconsin board approving late-term abortions at the flagship university of the state of Wisconsin, that one university that drives the engine of the Wisconsin economy, the University of Wisconsin. In a lopsided vote, as I mentioned yesterday, the University of Wisconsin board decided that it was a perfectly fine idea to potentially violate state and federal law in a taxpayer-funded university by funding late-term abortions and essentially taking away the conscience objections of some of its employees. So, sort of mystifyingly, they argue that this is about public health. This is about women's health. And they argued apparently successfully, indeed the news media covered it as such, that late-term abortions, second trimester abortions are about public health. Well, I don't accept that. And there's a reason I don't accept it, because it isn't true. Nobody even bothered to ask the question, though. What do you mean by public health? What do you mean by women's health? What do you mean by we're going to save lives here? What do you mean? Well, I asked the question, and I endeavored to get an answer by a doctor. I wanted to call a doctor, and I wanted to find out just what this health stuff is all about when it comes to abortions, specifically late-term abortions. And so I did this crazy thing. I picked up the phone, and I made a phone call, and I found a guy, an abortionist, former abortionist, who was able to walk everyone through this simple, benign procedure, and who was also able to provide for folks some context for the public health debate and for the women's health debate and for the women's lives debate. His name is Dr. Anthony Levitino. I had a chance to interview him yesterday, so this is a recorded interview. But because I thought it was... There's no religion in this interview. Nothing. It's a clinical description of what the University of Wisconsin, a taxpayer-funded university, has decided to do. And so I thought I would share with you my conversation with Dr. Anthony Levitino that I had with him yesterday. I want to tell you guys, though, what this common procedure is. And so what I've done is I've managed to get hold of an abortionist. And his name is, a former abortionist, let's be accurate here. His name is Dr. Anthony Levitino, and he joins me on the phone right now. Dr. Levitino, thank you for being on the show. Thank you for being willing to share your experiences.
You're welcome.
All right, well, first thing I want you to do, if we can, please, this is called a D&E. This is a simple, common procedure. This is a matter of women's public health, and it's just a procedure. It's dilation and evacuation. It sounds also innocent and clinical and medical and fine. So if you don't mind, since you've had experience doing this, could you walk people through the procedure?
I've in years past, when I did abortions, I did over 100 D&E abortions. There's nothing simple about it. In fact, because it was relatively dangerous, few physicians in my area of the country, which was upstate New York at the time, would even do the procedure. For your listeners, imagine for a minute that you're a pro-choice obstetrician-gynecologist, and you're going to do this abortion. Your patient today is 17. Let's make her 18 years old. Let's make her a college freshman over at University Wisconsin at Madison. And she's 18 years old, and she's 20 weeks pregnant. Her uterus is all the way up to her umbilicus, and she's been feeling her baby kick for the last 2 weeks. Now, just so you have an idea, because I can't do this visually, look at your hand. From the tip of your middle finger down to your wrist, that's the size of a 20-week baby. That's head to rump, not counting the legs. Now, you walk into that operating room, scrubbed and gowned, and your patient's asleep on the table, and to the right of the table, there's a set of instruments. And the first thing you reach for is a 14 French suction catheter. It's about 9 inches long. It's clear plastic with a hole through the middle. And you picture yourself, if you can, putting that catheter up through the cervix, up into the uterus. And you instruct your circulating nurse to turn on the suction machine. Now, what you'll see is some pale yellow fluid running through the tubing into the suction machine. That was the amniotic fluid that was there to protect the baby. Now, if she were 12 weeks pregnant or less, that would be a baby the width of your hand or smaller. You could do the whole abortion with that one instrument. That's a suction D&C abortion. But when babies are as big as your hand, they don't fit through catheters that size. So when you're done with that, you remove that, and you, you reach for your Sofer clamp. Now, a Sofer clamp is about 13 inches long. It's stainless steel, and the business end is about 2.5 inches long and a half inch wide, and there are rows of sharp teeth. It's a grasping instrument. When it gets a hold of something, it does not let go. Now, one of these suction DNA abortions, it's a blind procedure. You can't see anything. Everything has to be done by feel. So you picture yourself taking this 13-inch long grasping clamp, putting it up through the cervix, up into the uterus blindly. Now, be real careful, because it is easy as pie to perforate the uterus, to go right through the wall. And if you do that, you could damage the intestine, bladder, or one of the organs that's above the uterus. And what you do with this is you reach around blindly, because, again, you can't see anything, and just grab a hold of anything you can and feel yourself pulling, and I mean pulling hard. And all of a sudden, out pops a leg about, 4 inches long, which you put down on the table next to you. And then reach in with the clamp again, get a hold of anything you can, and start to pull, and I mean hard. And when suddenly it pops free, out pops an arm about 4 inches long, which you put down on the table next to you. And then you reach in with that clamp again and again, and you tear out the intestines, the spine, heart, and lungs. You know, a tough part of that procedure is the head, because the head of a baby that size is about the size of a plum, and now it's floating around free inside the uterus. And again, you can't see it, so you have to just kind of blindly reach around for it. And you have a pretty good idea you've got a hold of it if you've got a hold of something and your fingers are spread as far as the instrument will allow. And you know you did it right when you crush down on the clamp and some white material runs out of the cervix. That was the baby's brains. And then you can start pulling out skull pieces. And if you have a real bad day like I had a lot of days, sometimes a little face will come back and stare back at you. Congratulations. You just successfully performed a DNA abortion. You just affirmed her right to choose. You just made $600 cash in 15 minutes.
You didn't exaggerate.
No, that's what a DNA
that's
is.
It. You did them. You did these.
That's right.
And how often did you do these to save the life of that 18-year-old college student?
In my practice?
Yeah.
In my private practice over 5 years, I did 1,200 abortions, 1,100 first trimester and 100 second trimester abortions. Not a single one was, quote, to save the life of the mother. This business about how you need second trimester to save a woman's life is really way, way, way overblown. Here's what I mean. Before I moved, I live in New Mexico now, and for 8 years prior to moving to New Mexico, I was a member of the faculty at the Albany Medical College in Albany, New York. Albany Medical College is a tertiary referral center, meaning that's where all the really seriously ill pregnant patients come. And I saw hundreds of patients over those 8 years with serious, I mean really life-threatening conditions, heart disease, preeclampsia or blood pressure elevations in pregnancy. I mean, people would walk in the door with blood pressures 220 over 140. These women were just minutes away from a stroke. Severe diabetes, cancer, situations that where you had to end the pregnancy to treat the mother. You had to end the pregnancy process to save her life. But you know how we did it? We did premature deliveries. We did cesarean sections or inductions of labor in some cases and delivered the babies early and then treated the mother and the baby together. You hear these arguments all the time about how abortion procedures like DNE or partial birth abortion, even for later abortions, are necessary to save the mother's life. These arguments are rubbish, and they are rubbish for this reason. If a woman to prep a patient to do a DNE abortion, to be able to do what I described, you have to dive. The cervix is a pinpoint. It's small. Take a look at any woman on an exam table. To be able to do what I just described to a baby as big as your hand, you have to dilate the cervix with a substance called laminaria. It used to take 2 days for me to get them sufficiently dilated to do that procedure safely. In DNX abortion, otherwise known as partial birth abortion, read the original papers by, I forgot his name as I'm sitting here, but read the original papers describing the abortion. It takes 3 days to dilate the cervix sufficiently to do that procedure. When a woman walks into your hospital with a blood pressure of 240 over, you know, 220 over 140, you haven't got 3 days to save her life. If you wait 3 days to do that type of procedure to, quote, save her life, she will be dead and in the morgue long ago from serious complications. What we would do in those cases is stabilize the mother, do a cesarean section. We could do that within an hour. Get the baby out, get the baby into a high-risk nursery and take care of them, and then take care of the mom's problems. In all those years, 8 years of working at the Albany Medical Center, I saved hundreds of women who had serious problems that required that their pregnancies be ended to treat them. How many babies did I deliberately kill in all that time? The answer was zero.
Wow.
So any abortion. Abortion is worthless in situations where a mother's life is in danger.
So when the woman who is making the argument that if this were not available at the University of Wisconsin, the D&E abortion that you just described that takes 2 days in order to perform the procedure, the woman that she had described with a baby that had developed without a head, that's nonsense, is what you're saying.
That was not necessary
for, saving that woman's life.
What you're describing there is called anencephaly. It's a very rare condition. In my career of 30 years, I've seen two anencephalics. It doesn't mean they don't happen. They do happen, but they're pretty rare. So first off, you're trying to make a general rule based on very, very rare occurrences. That's the first thing. Second, anencephaly is a very special case. Those are cases of babies that will not survive outside the womb. They cannot survive outside the womb. No way, no how. The pregnancy itself does not threaten the mother's life, I mean, any more than any other pregnancy does. And so there's no emergent need to do an abortion for an anencephalic. Now, if you wanted to terminate an anencephalic, I mean, I'm a, quote, pro-life physician now. I oppose the idea of abortion on demand. On the other hand, politically, if you asked me, well, doctors, would you vote to allow an abortion in this case, specifically anencephaly? I'd say, yeah, sure, why not?
I think the Pope would sign off on that one.
I think the Pope would, too, as a matter of fact. But beyond that, sure, no problem. This is a very, very special circumstance.
But wouldn't that be taken care of by your OBGYN? I mean, is that necessary
exactly.
to have a whole clinic? I mean, it's not
they
like
can,
you can't.
They can induce labor.
Sure.
Your OB can do this.
Your OB will
do it. Your OB can
do
this at the hospital with appropriate consultation of the experts.
Nobody.
You don't have to create an abortion clinic for a situation that we'll probably see in your hospital once maybe every 2 years.
And the hospital's capable of taking care of this.
Of course they are.
Of course they are, because they're a hospital.
They've been doing it for years, haven't they?
Because they're the University of Wisconsin Hospital. They're some of the best people in the business. All right, another one of the straw man arguments that were thrown up was, this is about helping women through who have been victims of rape and incest. And so if we don't give them the opportunity to wait until they're 6 months pregnant, apparently we're going to punish people who've already been punished by a crime.
Well, you get that all the time, too.
How many times did you have to take care of that situation in your practice?
In my practice, every practice is conducted a little differently. I may have been a strong proponent of abortion on demand, and I proved it by actually being an abortionist. But we were extremely careful in my office in terms of counseling patients. Patients got extensive counseling on what their options were. And remember, and part of it, too, remember, you know, if you run an abortion clinic and, if you're running an abortion clinic, just as a for instance, and this may not be applicable at the university, but in a typical abortion clinic, if somebody chooses not to have an abortion, you just lost your income. In my office, I didn't care whether anybody had an abortion or was going to have a baby because I had them either way. We very carefully counseled our patients and got into the reasons why they were having abortions. Also, the other thing we would never do, never, ever, was touch a minor without parental consent. The laws in my state did not require it, but there was no way I was going to touch a patient without the consent of the parents. So in 1,200 abortions, I can tell you why every one of them had abortions. At the time, I had records. In all of those abortions, two of them had anything to do with rape and incest. So again, you're making a general rule based on a minority situation.
These are
not only that. Think for a minute. Who is it A woman is raped. This is a brutal crime, an absolutely brutal crime, or even worse, an incest case, and especially in an incest case, more common probably than rape cases, depending on especially where you are in the country. Now, guess when a case of incest occurs, who is it usually who's the perpetrator?
The dad.
A member of the family.
Yeah,
could
or
be
the,
dad
or
somebody
uncle.
Else.
Yeah.
Right. So, three guesses who's bringing the young lady in for the abortion.
The perpetrator.
The perp. So in the end, when all you do is cover up a crime like that with an abortion, in the many, many times, unless you're awfully careful, all you're doing is protecting the perpetrator. Then you send the young lady home to what? Exactly the same environment and exactly the same problem. Nobody knows accurately how many abortions are done specifically for rape and incest. As I said, I know my numbers. Two cases out of 1,200. That was my experience. Maybe 1%, we'd only be guessing. So fine, once more, I'll be happy to support a law that supports abortion only in the cases of rape and incest, only. Okay? And of course, by the way, we require that an arrest be made because a crime's been committed. But that has nothing to do with the vast majority of abortions you're talking about. These are all smoke screens. The vast, vast amount of abortions you're going to be dealing with at the University of Wisconsin are totally elective, I just don't feel like being pregnant abortions. And I've seen them all. Believe me, I did this for years. I had a 17-year-old walk into my office once requesting her fifth, get that, her fifth, abortion. I mean, this young lady needs a serious hobby. I had a young lady come in once requesting a second trimester abortion because she didn't want to be pregnant for her prom. I mean, I could go on and on and on.
And they really are. There are excuses as frivolous as what you just said.
Oh, my God, yeah, frequent. Now, you know, mostly, look, I'm afraid my father's going to find out I'm pregnant. I'm worried about my career. I'm worried about my finances. These are legitimate reasons why people are concerned and afraid of pregnancies. I understand that. I dealt with them for years. But trust me, the frivolous excuses far outnumber the kind of cases you've brought up so far, anencephaly or even rape and incest.
Well, and again, this is, we're talking, you said, so your index finger to the butt of your hand, and that's not including the legs.
That's the head to rump on a roughly a 20-week baby.
And
by the way, DNA abortions you're talking about can be done up to 23 or 24 weeks. I did them at 23 weeks.
22 to 23, up to 24
weeks. At 24, now you're a hand and a half tall.
And these are, I had just looked up, you know, it was the earliest preemie to survive, and I think it was 19 weeks, so that's a little disturbing. Well, to say the least, it's beyond a little disturbing.
It's very difficult. It's a tough procedure to do, even as a physician. We used to have real problems just keeping nurses and circulating people in those rooms. They would try it out, and after a couple of weeks, you know, we'd lose them. I mean, it was not all that unusual. We had frequent turnovers in those rooms. It's a gruesome, horrible procedure. You know, it's just, you know, if people want, it's perfectly, you know, people will tell you, hey, abortion's legal. Yep, it's legal. And you have every legal right to support abortion on demand if you want. But just don't kid yourself about what it is you're supporting.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you sharing your experiences with us and your story so bluntly.
My pleasure.
Most people wouldn't do what you did. Dr. Levitino, Anthony Levitino, I know you're a busy guy, and I really appreciate your time today, and hopefully you have enlightened some people out there. Let's cross our fingers.
I hope so, too.
Take care. Dr. Anthony Levitino, my guest.
That was an interview I conducted yesterday. Am I bugging you? Does that bug you a little bit? Does it bother you? Make you uncomfortable? Just a procedure. It's reproductive justice. You shouldn't be bothered by that. No reason to be bothered by that. That's what our culture teaches us, and that's what the University of Wisconsin said when it agreed to be ground zero for second trimester abortions in Wisconsin. Congratulations.